Okay, so for this evening's Dhamma talk, I'd like to talk about something a little bit more prosaic than aliens and cyborgs, and I'd like to talk about the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the most important teachings of Buddhism. In fact, quite possibly the single most important teaching in all of Buddhism, the topic of the Buddha's first Dhamma talk. Well, actually, the topic of the Buddha's second Dhamma talk. It's something we tend to gloss over. We talk about the Buddha's first sermon as being the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma. But actually, his first talk was when the Buddha gave a talk to or spoke with Upaka, the wanderer who he met on the road, and he tried to convince Upaka, but Upaka wasn't convinced and walked off down the other road shaking his head. So this is something which I find very personally inspiring as a Dhamma teacher, to know that the Buddha's first attempt at teaching was a complete failure. I'm like, I don't feel so bad. So the first one that actually worked was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the famous discourse in Benares to the group of five ascetics. And that's where the Buddha talked about the middle way. And so often, you know, we use this idea, we talk these days about the middle way. Sometimes people in Western Buddhism sort of think that it's the upper middle way. But actually, it's not meaning a middle class way. It's certainly not meaning a mediocre way. I've heard it translated that time. It doesn't mean the mediocre way, right? It's neither too good or too bad. No, that's not the meaning. And it's not like an average way either. What the middle way is, a way that avoids the two extremes, right? So the two extremes, the Buddha said, is indulgence and self-indulgence and self-torment, right? These two extremes. And if we look at how we often live our lives, then we see that often that's exactly what we do. We bounce around between these two extremes, right? And this is a well-known psychological fact, right? If you get up in the morning and you think, oh, what shall I have for breakfast? I'll have, you know, bacon and eggs for breakfast. And then you think, no, I'll be virtuous. I'll have a grapefruit for breakfast. You think, oh, okay, fine. So morning tea time comes along and you think, wow, I was so good at breakfast time. I think I can have a little bit of chocolate cake for morning tea. Yeah. So that's what we tend to do. We bounce around between the two extremes. So the middle way isn't a way of kind of averaging out these two extremes. You know, I have a bit of this extreme and a bit of that extreme, and therefore I'll be okay. Right? But it's about looking at things in a completely different way, right? Approaching them from a totally different perspective. It's got nothing to do with these kinds of extremes. So for this evening, I'd like to talk about the Eightfold Path and talk about what's in the Eightfold Path. But what's perhaps even least as important or more important actually is all the things that's not in the Eightfold Path. Okay, so we talk about the Eightfold Path. Now, I'm tempted to ask everybody to raise their hands if they know what fact, how many, all of the eight factors of the Eightfold Path. Should I do that? Or would that be too shaming for too many people? But it's a good thing to know, right? You should know what these things are. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, okay? Eight factors. And I'm going to repeat these eight factors a number of times during the talk this evening. And if you have good mindfulness and awareness, then you'll be able to remember them, okay, by the end of the talk, okay? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. Okay, so I'll talk a bit about a few of them. But first of all, notice what isn't in these eight factors, okay? Rituals, okay? Not part of the Eightfold Path. Yeah, bowing and chanting and hanging Christmas decorations outside, all of these things. These are not part of the Eightfold Path. Relics, Buddha images, holy water blessings, all of those things are not part of the Eightfold Path. Sacred tattoos, also not part of the Eightfold Path. Amulets, right? The ability to predict next week's lottery number, also not part of the Eightfold Path. Yeah? making the ability to build big, shiny temples, also not part of the Eightfold Path. So many of the things that we find in modern Buddhism actually has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. It's not the Eightfold Path. It's not what the Buddha was talking about. And if you think in the Buddha's day, right, take yourself back to that time and imagine how radical this was. Okay. The Buddha didn't even bother saying you don't have to worry about doing rituals. He just ignored it completely. Okay, and this is elsewhere he did say that, right? But in the Eightfold Path, and this is in India, right? This is a land steeped in superstition and ritual and sacrifice and tradition and law and all of these kinds of things. And the Buddha just swept them all away at one stroke. Yeah. It's very, very powerful to think about that. The content of so much religion, even today, okay? Even today, so much religious practice revolves around these things, rituals and liturgies and sacraments and all of those things. And it's not part of the Eightfold Path at all. So a lot of times people argue or they say that Buddhism isn't really a religion because it doesn't have all of those things that religion has. But of course it does. Buddhism has all of those things, right? It has liturgies and doesn't have sacrifices, but it has rituals and so on. But none of them are essential to what we're doing. They're not really the core. They're just the outer decoration. And yeah, it's true that many times, perhaps most of the time, that outer decoration gets mistaken for the Buddha's message. But it really has nothing to do with what the Buddha was talking about. And one thing to notice, right, is how fast this all changed, okay? The Buddha lived for 45 years, teaching the Dhamma for 45 years, right? And from the very first time he taught the Dhamma, right, up until the very last words that he said, Vayadhamma Sankhara, Appamadena Sampadeta, the Buddha's last words. A literal translation is all conditioned phenomena are subject to ceasing. Strive on with diligence. Okay. That's a formal translation. A more informal translation would be things fall apart. Yeah. Keep trying. Keep going. That was his last word. He's still talking about the same thing from the very first teaching to the very last. And when the Buddha passed away, you know how long it took for the Buddhist community to forget about that? The ashes weren't cold on the Buddha's funeral fire before the people in the Buddhist community started arguing about who was going to get the share of the Buddha's relics so they could go off and worship all of his relics. And in the Parinibbana Sutta, it says that they even came to the brink of going to war, that the rival clans disputing over the Buddha's relics were on the verge of going to war and to battle. While the Buddha's funeral fire was, coals were still warm on his funeral fire. That's how quickly it all degenerates. That's how quickly those 45 years of teaching can be forgotten. So when that happened, straight away, that very same day, you know, we shouldn't be surprised to see that these things get almost lost these days. So when we think about Buddhism, or think about the Dhamma, think about practice, what we're doing here, actually don't worry too much about Buddhism. Don't worry too much about all the things you see in different Buddhist traditions and so on. None of those things are all that important. The only thing that really matters is the Dhamma. And that Dhamma, the practice that really matters, is the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you think about it, you reflect about all of those factors, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, you think that there is nothing superfluous there, right? You can't leave anything out. and nor is there anything missing. Right? It's not that the Buddha taught this and then said, okay, now, you know, then you've got to go and add all this other stuff to make it work properly. Right? It's just right as it is. So we need to have a sense for what it is that the Buddha was teaching, and a sense to be resisting the sort of the fossilization, the things that are piled on top of the Dhamma. And this is something that you find in is actually a part of every Buddhist culture. And it's a part of every living Buddhist tradition, is that that within the tradition, there's always a rebirth, a sort of an emerging, like the traditions become stale and old and crusty and fossilized, and that there's always a new life coming from within then, a return to those original teachings, a finding of the power and the strength within those things. And this is an ongoing process of evolution and change, which you can see happening within all of the Buddhist traditions that are alive today. And when we return to these Buddha's teachings, the things that the Buddha himself talked about and insisted on and explained again and again and again through his whole life, then no matter who we are, no matter what our background is or what our age is or what our gender is or what our race is or even what religion we believe in, it doesn't matter. What matters is being able to find the truth within that Eightfold Path and be able to apply it and be able to live it and be able to use it to let go of suffering. Okay? So I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these factors in the Eightfold Path. Of course, should not even need saying that we can talk for all night on just one factor, but I'm just going to briefly survey all of them. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. First factor, right view. Sometimes mistranslated as right understanding, but that's not correct. Right view is right view. What this means is that at the beginning of the path, okay, the beginning of the path, that we have an idea about what we're doing, okay? This isn't a vision of the truth, right? This isn't an understanding of the true nature of reality. It's just an idea, okay? That's where you've got to start with. Okay, that's not the finish of the path, but that's the beginning of it. So right view means understanding impermanence, understanding ultimately the Four Noble Truths, understanding that the suffering that we experience in our lives, the important cause of suffering, the meaningful cause of suffering, is not our noisy neighbors, it's not the government, right? It's not the economy, it's not our boss. It's in here. It's in here. Greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the cause of suffering. So to understand that if we want to let go of that suffering, then it's up to us to practice, up to us to do what's necessary. That's the Four Noble Truths. That's the start of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? Now, when we first look at this, there's a number of different aspects to it. The first part of it is simply hearing, okay, getting the idea, or maybe seeing written somewhere, and getting a first kind of taste or first contact. Ah, this the Buddha's talking about peace of mind. You know, I feel agitated and stressed a lot of the time. Wouldn't it be lovely to have some of that peace of mind? And so there's an initial recognition, that these troubles, these problems that I'm experiencing, that's also something that the Buddha was talking about. So maybe I can start that practice. Maybe I can start to look at that. And so there, we think about a number of different ways of improving and purifying this right view. First of all is hearing the teachings, hearing Dhamma talks, reading articles, reading books and so on, especially reading the Buddha's own words in the suttas. And nothing will ever equal the words of the Buddha himself. Thank you very much for that reminder of impermanence. Right? What could be better than the words of the Buddha himself? So it's hearing those teachings, but not enough just to hear it. It's not enough just to sit there and passively soak things up, okay? You're not a sponge. Brains don't work that way, okay? Ask anybody who works in education or anything like that whether that's a way you're going to understand things and really know things. No, that's not it. That's not how you'll do it. Not only do you have to hear it or learn it, you also have to reflect about it, right? You have to think about it. You have to critically analyze it. You have to look, what does this mean? What does that mean? Try and work it out in your mind. Oh, how does this bit equate to that? But they said this bit earlier and this bit later, but they sound like they're different. Is that a contradiction? And so on. And so you have to reflect and think about things, work out what they mean. Yeah? And when I'm talking to school kids and people who are doing studies and things, I often say to them, don't do homework. Parents don't like me very much for some reason. I never did any homework. Look, see, I'm fine. Don't do tutoring. What a terrible idea to do tutoring. My God, you're at school all day stuffing your head full of knowledge and then you come home and it's as if you can stuff your head full of more knowledge. That'd be ridiculous. You know what it's like, right? If you've been, you know, in a class or something like that, after a while your brain gets fritzed out. You can't learn anything more. It's absurd. Yeah? So you should tell your kids, don't do tutoring, don't do homework and things like that. What you do is you pay attention, right? In the class, you listen to what the teacher's saying. Pay attention. Meditate before every lesson. Meditate after every lesson, even just for a couple of minutes. Pay attention. Reflect on it. Understand it. And you should be able to summarize the lesson in 4 points, 4 or 5 points, okay? Same with tonight's talk. You should be able to write a summary at the end, 4 or 5 points, right? That's what the talk was about. If you can't do it in 4 or 5 points, you don't understand it. Yeah. I see people sometimes writing this, and they end up with like pages and pages of notes or something. That's not understanding. Yeah. Understanding, you just have a few points, you know, oh, okay, and from there everything can come. Right? So this is a capacity to reflect, to be able to inquire. And this is not something you either have or don't have. It's something you learn, okay? And please don't think that this is just something I'm saying as a Western monk because of my Western education bias, right? This is something which the Buddha said in the suttas many, many, many times, right? That you hear the teachings, you memorize it, and that you think and reflect over and investigate those teachings with wisdom, okay? Many, many times he said this. Right? So that's how wisdom comes. But it's not just that, right? But it's also discussion. Okay, so there's a time for, you know, like a listening, right? But there's also a time for discussing the Dhamma, talking about it with your friends. Either, you know, sometimes if you have a teacher or something like that, you can talk about it with them. Otherwise, just among yourselves, ask, what was the meaning of this? What was that about? Oh, I really connected with that bit, but I didn't understand what this bit was about at all. Right? And you talk about it and you reflect about it. And also, this is how we learn. Okay? Again, any teacher, anyone who's trained in education will tell you the same thing. And I think it's puzzling how all of these things are mentioned in the Buddha suttas. And the Buddha actually said these things quite explicitly and clearly and repeatedly, again and again and again. This is how you understand the Dhamma. And yet, they seem to be almost ignored in the Buddhist traditions, where the Buddhist tradition is based in most of them, as far as I can see, are based almost entirely on passive and didactic learning, right? You just say, this is what the Dhamma is, and you tell them, and then you have to sort of learn that. And there's no encouragement of critical thought, no encouragement of inquiry, no encouragement of reflection. I know that's not always the case, but in the vast majority of cases, in my experience anyway, that's how the Buddhist tradition is. So we need to bring these things back, which are actually part of how the Buddha taught the Dhamma. So this is how we investigate and how we reflect our right view. We call up our own views to question. And you especially notice those moments when you react against the teaching, right? When I say something that you go, oh, hang on, that's not right. Yeah? That's when you need to investigate and say, oh, what's going on there? is it really true? Sometimes maybe you are right. Sometimes maybe I do say something wrong. Okay? Other times, maybe I've triggered a nerve. Maybe I've hit something and you need to investigate that and look at that. So when we reflect in this way, we always try to step back from it. We recognize that views are just views. Views are not reality. A view is just a map. Okay? So it's a map from here to there. That's all. But don't expect a map to be perfect. Right? And this is one of the things that sometimes we can have a problem with in Buddhism. We somehow get this idea the Buddha was such a wonderful teacher, such a beautiful teacher, and we think that means that everything on that map must be entirely perfect and so on and so forth. But that's not the point. A map doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to get you there. Right? That's all that matters, that you get from point A to point B. So a map just has to be good enough. So this is how we develop our right view. Learning, studying the Dhamma, reflecting about it, discussing it, and then we apply it in our own experience. Okay? We hear about a teaching like impermanence. I ask, what does that mean? And you can look around in your life. You can say, oh, okay, my house is impermanent. I can see bits are falling off it. My clothes are impermanent. My body's impermanent. And then you go and you sit in meditation. And you look into your mind. And you realize, oh, my mind also is impermanent. It's changing. My thoughts are changing. My feelings are changing. My moods are changing. My memories are changing. My perceptions are changing. Everything's changing. And sometimes when you go into meditation, then everything starts to crackle and pop. It's like the world starts to collapse in on itself. You get this deep perception of impermanence. And everything's just like sand falling down around you. And so you've taken those teachings and you've applied it in your own heart and you've seen, this is actually how the world works. Right? So you don't take anything for granted. You never take anything for granted in Buddhism. You always take it as a proposition, as a hypothesis, something which is to be tested, something which, yes, okay, you've got it on a reliable authority. If it comes from the Buddha was the best. He was the best teacher, I think, anyway, obviously, right? I'm biased, okay? Right? So, but don't let that cloud your judgment, okay? You need to find the truth for yourself. And all of the suttas in the world, all of the Dhamma teachings in the world, frankly, they don't matter in the slightest. You know, like it says in the Dhammapada, you know, better than 1,000 words is one word, hearing which you find peace. That's all that matters in the end. What's that? What is that thing that lets you find peace, that lets you let go, so that you realize, that's Dhamma. That's not just words anymore, right? It's not just ideas. That's the experience of Dhamma. So this right view is an evolving thing. It's a growing thing. It's a flowing thing. Yeah? We don't start out by getting everything right. We start out by getting most things wrong and maybe a few things right, and gradually we purify it and deepen it. So right view. Next factor, right intention. Defined as intention of non-ill will, non-harming, and of letting go, nekkhamma sankappa. I was at a conference last year in Vienna. It was a Religions for Peace World Congress, and there was a number of different panels on interfaith issues, and one of them was dealing with climate change. And this fellow was giving this talk on climate change. And, you know, this is like an interfaith conference, so I didn't know this person or where he came from. And he was talking, and he said something like that, we're going to have to consider the necessity of... And then he paused. he couldn't find the word. He was looking for the word, the necessity of, and he was looking for the word, and he said, nekama. Yeah? Nekama is a Pali word. It means renunciation, letting go. And when he said that, I knew, ah, he must be a Buddhist. So that was very interesting to see. This is like in an international forum where renunciation, letting go, is that that word actually dares to be spoken. My goodness. What a powerful thing. Right? It's going directly against the way of the world. You know, I went, the other day I was doing a talk in Taiping in Malaysia, and we were driving to the talk and we went through the center of the town. And Taiping's a kind of medium-sized city. It's not a very big place, but there's these huge new shopping centers that they've built there, massive multi-story shopping complexes and things, you know. And we're driving past these things and we're on our way to the Buddhist center, and I knew, well, there'll be like 20 or 30 people at the Buddhist center come to hear about letting go. And thousands and thousands in that shopping center. Oh. Renunciation. And his point that he was making was a very powerful one. Is that in the past, we always tend to think of renunciation as being like a monastic virtue, right? It's monks and nuns, that's what they do, right? They give up everything and they shave their hair and they, you know. That's not what we do, right? We don't do that renunciation thing. It's for them to do. Yeah? Actually, it's part of the Eightfold Path. It's something for everyone to do. Yeah? Maybe you do it to different degrees. But the point that he was making is that this has now moved from being, if you like, a spiritual value to being a survival value. Our life is lived out of balance. Our life is lived in a way which is unsustainable. This word sustainability has become weakened and corrupted over the years. But what it means is, can we keep on doing this? Can we keep on living this way? And the answer is, no, we can't. We cannot keep on living this way. We have to learn to renounce. We must learn to renounce. So these things, this intention. So how does that? How do you do that in your life, right? How do you actually practice that virtue of renunciation, right? People say, how do you let go? It's so hard to let go of things. It's not hard to let go of things. It's easy. Letting go of things is the easiest thing in the world. It's much easier than holding on to them. And I can prove it. That's not a subjective opinion. That's scientific fact. Okay, do you want me to prove it to you? Yes, okay. See, now I'm holding on to this bell donger thingy, right? Now, which is easier, holding on or letting go, right? One of the things that we learned in biology in high school, right, is that we have like complementary sets of muscles. Yeah, we have the contracting muscles and the expanding ones, right? In the hand. Yeah. So these ones are for holding on, these ones are for letting go. Which one is stronger? Yeah? The contracting muscles are stronger. Why? Because holding on is hard. Right? We don't need strong muscles to be able to let go, because letting go is easy. Holding on is hard. People say to me, oh, being a monk is really hard. Oh, it must be really hard. What do you mean it's really hard? I've never filled out a tax return. I have the best boss in the world. Ajahn Brahm is my boss, right? Imagine that. Imagine if the worst complaint that you had to make about your boss was that he told too many silly jokes. Okay? Right? It's easy. Being a monk is the easiest thing in the world. Yeah? It's all about letting go. People say, how do I start letting go? How do I begin? I say, well, begin gradually. Let go of the easy things. They say, what's the easy things? I say, your job, your house, your car, your family. Right? your career, your identity, your name, okay, then you can start to look at the subtle things and the more hard things after that. Letting go, yeah. So that intention of renunciation, letting go, giving up. Always just ask yourself, what if I didn't have that? What would it be like? You know, the next time you go to the shopping centre, you think, oh, it would be really good to have that. You know, what would it be like not to have it? Letting go, loving kindness. So this second factor of the Eightfold Path, the Sammasankappa, right intention, it's really about what's the kind of the overall kind of emotional tone and attitude that you're having, right? That's giving a direction to your life and a direction. And so the right view component is more about understanding. It's at least in the beginning, it's more of an intellectual component, and the right intention is more of an emotional component, like loving kindness, compassion, and so on. It's moving you, right? That idea of emotion, right? It's a moving. One of the most crucial things to remember about the Eightfold Path is that it's an integrated path. Okay? Actually, I should have mentioned this earlier, but this is very, very important to understand. The Eightfold Path, an integrated path. What does that mean to say something's integrated? Well, the word integration is a kind of a psychological sort of buzzword, but basically what it means is something like this, that the factors of the Eightfold Path are each distinct, but they're interrelated. Okay? So what that means is we can't collapse the Eightfold Path into just one thing or another, right? So this is what people try to do all the time. Oh, just be mindful, right? Then you don't have to worry about those other things. Oh, you don't need to study the suttas. You don't need to learn Dhamma. You don't need to talk about it. You just be mindful, right? Or else somebody will say, oh, just keep precepts and that's enough. Yeah? Or just give dana and that's enough. Or just something and that's enough. Just study Abhidhamma, that's enough. Right? No, it's not enough. You have to practice the whole of the Eightfold Path. Every factor has its particular role and its particular function. And it can't be replaced by any other factor. This is why the Buddha said you overcome wrong view with right view. You don't overcome wrong view with meditation. Okay? If you think I'm just going to meditate and somehow my view is going to be magically purified, it's nonsense. It doesn't happen. Right? You don't overcome wrong intention by purifying your right effort or your mindfulness or something. You overcome wrong intention with right intention. So each factor has to be developed in its own with its own quality and its own nature. They're distinct. Of course they're related. Of course they're connected. But don't think that you can somehow skip over things. That's just laziness. Right intention, right speech. Okay, so right speech is something which there's a causal connection there, isn't there? So there's like a strong strong connection between what's our intention, what's our motivation, and what do we talk about? What is our speech like? Now, often in Buddhism, right speech is often sort of watered down until it becomes like don't lie. You just keep a precept for not lying or something like that. But actually, right speech is always very, very often defined by the Buddha or described in very positive terms. Right speech is not no speech. Right speech is speech on the Dhamma and on the Vinaya, speech which is meaningful, speech which is at the right time, speech which is going to the heart, speech which is pleasing to the ear, speech which is delightful to the many folk, speech which is reconciling those who are divided, speech which is in favor of harmony. This kind of speech is right speech. Right? So don't think that somehow by not saying anything that you're going to be practicing right speech. In fact, it says quite explicitly in our monk's discipline, we recite every fortnight, it says at the beginning of that if you have, it's talking to the monks, and we're supposed to confess if we have any offences before that recitation. And it says before that if you have any offences, that you should confess it. If you do not confess it, then if you remain silent while the recitation is proceeding, then this is false speech. Okay? So in that context, keeping silence is actually wrong speech. So that shows that, yes, of course, silence in many cases is beautiful, is wonderful, and we could all do with more of it. But it's not always the right thing to do. We need to learn to speak at the right time with speech that's meaningful. Is that right speech? And that is a lot harder. Right? Usually when we have that thing in our mind, oh, we're not going to say anything, it's because it's a lot easier to not say something. Right? Okay, right speech, right action, right? Not to kill, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct. Okay, so that's the basic precepts. But once again, that right action actually encompasses a whole lot more. How do you live your life? How do you live a life of harmlessness? Everything that you do physically has an impact, right? Are you throwing rubbish on the ground? Well, that has an impact. It causes harm, right? What kinds of things are you buying? What kind of food are you buying? And that causes harm, right? There's an economic cost to all of these things. How do we live our life? Do you turn the aircon on and leave it on all day using lots of electricity because, hey, I've got lots of money and who cares? Right? Or do you actually care about the environment, care about our planet, care about other people? And so everything that we do physically needs to reflect this attitude of actually caring. Right? Not just, can I get by? Right? Oh, I'm not actually breaking any precepts, so that's all right. Right? That's not good enough. You have to think, how can I do something better? How can I live a life? It says in the description of this in the suttas, it says filled with compassion for all sentient beings. So how can I make my every action reflect that compassion? How can I be more loving and kind to every person that I meet during the day? How can I make these people that I'm with that bit happier or that bit more comfortable? How can I try to put them at their ease? What can I do to help those people who are around me? What can I do to share the money that I earn, the possessions that I have, the time that I have, the skills that I have? What can I do to give and to share those things with others? This is that attitude. And you notice how this is always coming from that right intention, right? So you're understanding the loving kindness, the compassion, the letting go. But you put that into practice. It's not just about sitting there on a meditation mat and saying, may all beings be happy. Get out there and make them happy, whether they like it or not. You will be happy. Right? So there's always more that we can do. Right? Ask ourselves, how can I live my life to be of service and benefit to others? You know, so often when we come to Buddhism these days, when we come to spiritual practice, we're coming to like, what can I get out of it? Right? Oh, I'm feeling suffering, you know, make my suffering go away. Right? It's all about me and my suffering. To be honest, the quickest and most effective way to get rid of your suffering is not meditation, it's helping people. Yeah? Really? Yeah? Meditation, you'll sit and suffer and suffer and suffer a lot, maybe get some peace after a while. But so often, just doing something to help somebody, and then you get a smile at the end of that straight away. And as you see in traditional Buddhist cultures, this is one of the strengths of those Buddhist traditions, is that they emphasize that service so much. There's such a strong basis in that, working together with a community. This is right action. Okay, right livelihood. Okay, again, it's got a very narrow definition, you know, of not trading in meat, not trading in live animals, not trading in human beings, not trading in weapons, not trading in chemicals. Oh, intoxicants is in there somewhere. Hang on, I've got it confused. Anyway, something like that. There you go. I'd fail my own test now. Okay, so these right livelihood. Now, of course, all those things are very harmful forms of livelihood, and we should try not to do them. But, of course, there are many other things that we do today that are also wrong livelihood. I was with somebody in KL the other day, and they were just saying, oh, yeah, their husband used to have a job in advertising, right? And I was like, oh, dear. But now they've got a new job with the government working out how to promote health and road safety. So I thought, oh, that's good. That's much better livelihood, isn't it, right? Promoting health, promoting road safety, it's good. Yeah, that's a good livelihood. So we've got to think, you know, actually, simple fact, right? You spend how long a day at work? You know, 8 hours a day at work. How long do you spend meditating? 8 hours a day? 6 hours? 4? 2? 1? Half an hour? If we're lucky? Yeah? So which is more important? Can you go to work and get stressed out? And it's not just about the stress at work, right? But the biggest thing and the biggest problem we have now is meaning, right? This is the single biggest problem. Our work has been stripped of meaning. Yeah? You think about like traditional ways of livelihood, you know? You're a farmer. Yeah, farmer is a lot of suffering, right? Yes, you get up early in the morning, you work a hard physical labor all day and all of this kind of stuff. But it's very meaningful work. You're in the ground and in the soil and you plant that food and you watch it grow and then you take it and you cook it and you feed it to your family. And what a special day that is when that first day of the new harvest and you've taken your food. When I was in northeast Thailand, you'd see that there's a special joy. They'd always bring the first rice of the harvest. They'd always cook and bring to the monastery and offer it to the monks on that day. Yeah? And they were so happy because you'd seen the result of all of that work that you'd done. Yeah? And it's there. It's meaningful. It's real. As of course, these days, who has that? There's so yeah, some people do. But very few of us have that, right? Usually we're some kind of meaningless cog in some mindless, meaningless machine. And if we were to quit tomorrow, nobody would notice. Right? I mean, it depends what job we do. There's a lot of jobs we do that do have a sense of meaning. If you're in the caring professions, for example, or if you're teaching, yeah, if you're in the medical profession, right, then yes, you can have a lot of meaning in your work. But a lot of the time when we're doing, especially office work and so on, it's very hard to find that sense of meaning. So don't ignore that. Don't think it's a small thing. As you go to work every day and you do that work, little bit by little bit, right, that sense of purpose and value that you have in your life is getting drained away from you. So see what you can do to turn that around. And to do some kind of work that's actually going to help people, and where you see how your work actually helps people, you see the results of it. This is a right livelihood. The last three factors of the path is right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And in these factors, we're coming much more into meditation. Right? Now, actually, of course, only the last factor, right, samadhi, is restricted solely to meditation. Right effort and right mindfulness can also apply to all of the factors of the Eightfold Path. Right? You put an effort into developing right view and abandon wrong view. Put an effort to develop right intention and abandon wrong intention. Put an effort to develop right speech, right action, right livelihood. So, yes, they apply all the way through. But the main focus here becomes looking into your mind, understanding your mind, and developing your mind directly. And in this regard also, you know, Buddhism, I think, is very distinct and very unusual in the world's religions. Yes? I think it's very unusual to find that the specific topic of mental and psychological and personal development treated so explicitly and so clearly and so centrally in the basic teachings of what is our religious practice, what's our religious duties. So right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. Only briefly mention what these things are about today. So right effort means the effort to abandon what's unwholesome and to develop what's wholesome. Okay? The crucial thing with right effort is to not give up. The most important, the most powerful kind of effort is not anything that's extreme. It's not staying up all night to meditate. Right? You know, I've stayed up all night to meditate dozens and dozens and dozens of times. maybe hundreds of times. It's okay, whatever. But that's not the real thing. That's not what really makes a difference. The thing that really makes a difference is persistence. And sometimes we think that, you know, we maybe look at like great meditators or practitioners. You look at someone like Tenzin Palmo, the great Tibetan bhikkhuni, who spent years living in the cave in the snow, and you think, wow, I could never do that. You know, you read her biography, and then, you know, she lived for how many years it was, living in, she's just like meditating in a box in this cave in the Himalayan mountain, year after year after year. And then she was asked a question, like, what, if there was anything that, you know, that you regret or something during that period? And she said, yeah, I think I wasn't really trying hard enough. And you hear things like that, and you go, oh, right? But right, that's not what right effort means, okay? You know, there'll come a time in your life when you're capable of putting forth that supreme kind of effort like that, right? But that doesn't have to be like that. Right effort just means that you recognize, what's this thought I have? Is that wholesome or unwholesome? Is that a thought of greed or a thought of letting go? Is that a thought of hatred or a thought of love? Is that a thought of wisdom or a thought of stupidity and ignorance? And being able to recognize that and let that go, but to do it persistently. I'll give you a good example of how that's put into practice. This is a story from the time of King Ashoka, and it involves a monk called Shanakavasin and his student Upagupta, and how Upagupta came to be a monk. And Upagupta was a son of a merchant, and he used to look after a shop. And Shanakavasin was a monk, a senior monk, and he used to come past the shop for alms round. And every day Upagupta would give him some alms, and he'd go on. And eventually Upagupta became very inspired, and he wanted to become a monk. So he said to Shanakavasin, "Venerable sir, I'd like to come and ordain with you." And Shanakavasin said, "Not yet." He said, "Well, what do I have to do to be ready?" He said, "Okay, I'll give you a practice to do." So he said, "I want you to go down to the river and pick up pebbles, black pebbles and white pebbles, and bring them back to the shop." So that's what he did. So he made a pile on the shop counter of black pebbles and white pebbles. And he said to him, "Okay, every time that you have a good thought, you need to put a white pebble in the pile, and every time you have a bad thought, you put a black pebble in the pile. That's all. Can you do that?" He said, "Sure, I can do that." So then at the end of the day, there was a big pile of black pebbles with one or two white pebbles in there. He thought, okay, that's interesting. And he kept on doing it day after day after day. And slowly, after many days, there was a few more white pebbles in the pile at the end of the day. A few more. Until one day, there was just all white pebbles and no black ones. And then Shanakavasin said, "Okay, you're ready to ordain now." And so he went and ordained and became a great monk. So I love that story so much. It's so practical, so straightforward. But the thing that's important about it is that he never said to him, "Stop thinking bad thoughts and only think good thoughts." Okay? It's not about making yourself change your mind. Okay? It's about recognizing what's going on. It's about understanding. It's about mindfulness and awareness. That's a good thought. That's a bad thought. That's all you need to do. You recognize it. But you do it persistently, and that's the right effort. To not give up. To not forget about it. And this was one of the big problems and the big secrets in Buddhism that we don't tell you until it's too late. Okay? Is that you can never really forget. Yeah? Once you've heard the teachings on the Dhamma, you know, your happiness and your suffering come from within you. And then all those times when you'd really like to forget that, yeah, when you're having the most delicious meal or the greatest party or something like that, and you're really, then in the back of your mind is whispering this voice, it's all impermanent. Just taste sucking all of the fun out of everything. We didn't tell you about that beforehand, so bad luck, it's too late now. So I'm kind of exaggerating there, but there is something to that. It's something, it's like it puts things into perspective. right? Once you understand, then there's a reflection about things, right? You can still have those things. You can still do things. You can still have that fun and enjoy those things and all of those things. But at the same time, you reflect on it and you know, oh, actually, it is impermanent. It's just that much. And then when it comes to an end, you're like, okay, it's over. That's the end. So this is that right effort, is that persistence of reflection. Right mindfulness. I've run out of time for the right mindfulness now, but right mindfulness, mainly in the suttas, right mindfulness means meditation. In fact, the word satipatthana we usually translate as establishments of mindfulness or foundations of mindfulness. But the way that it's used in the suttas, you could almost just translate it as meditation, actually. This is what it means, sitting down, watching your breath, and doing those other forms of meditation. Mindfulness specifically as a mental quality means something like continuity, keeping things in mind, right? Sustaining your awareness, sustaining your observation and knowing, right? So that your mind's not distracted and going here and there, one thing and then the other and so on, but that ability to rest and be peaceful and be content and to stay with one thing for a long time. This is that mindfulness, that right mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And the last factor of the Eightfold Path, of course, right samadhi. And you'll notice that I haven't translated it because there isn't a word in English that means samadhi. They translate it as concentration. That's very bad. I think Ajahn Brahm has probably talked about this many times here, so I won't go on about it too long. But concentration is just a wrong translation of samadhi, should never have been used, and it's very misleading. Right? The word samadhi in an Indian context is an extremely exalted word. It means, you know, if you look at it, what does it mean in Hinduism? In Hinduism, samadhi means something like the transcendental union of the self with the divinity, which is the cosmos. Okay? That's what samadhi means. That doesn't mean concentration, right? Okay? And so in Buddhism, we don't understand it in that same sort of metaphysical language, right? But it's the same kind of experience that we're talking about. Right? We're talking about a very profound coalescence where the mind comes together as one. Everything in the mind is bright and radiant, and you're absorbed into an experience of sheer bliss and light like nothing you've ever experienced before. And to call that concentration is to entirely miss the point of what it's about. So I think there simply isn't a word in English that even comes close to what samadhi is. And believe me, we've tried, you know, and this is something in the monks, we talked about this endlessly, you know, what word do we use, and we tried different things, and really just nothing works, so we just have to keep it as samadhi. Actually, you find in most of the Buddhist cultures, that's what they did, like in Thailand, they just say samadhi, in Chinese, it's like sanmei, they use it's like a transliteration of the term rather than a translation. And in many of the cultures, it's like that. Because it is such a special and unique experience. I don't think it's something we should try to translate. So this is like the culminating point of the path. It's where all of those factors of the path come together. Okay? And from that is the deep insights, and the deep liberations, the deep freedoms. And when those things happen, and when all of those factors of the path have come together, that's when you understand, okay, that's what I was doing. I started out with that right view. I started listening to Dhamma talks. I started out by thinking about the Dhamma, reading a book, chatting with my friends, asking questions, reflecting on it, meditating on it. I tried to improve my intention, live a life with more kindness and more compassion, with more letting go. And then I did my right speech. I tried to be less abusive and harmful when I was talking to people, and I was able to express myself in a more gentle and meaningful way. And then I practice the right action, living my life in a way that's harmless and which is giving benefit to all sentient beings around me. And then I tried to practice the right livelihood and do a job that's meaningful and that helps people. And I practice the right effort by meditating every day and right mindfulness, right? And the right samadhi. And all of those things have come together. And that's how it works. That's how all of these factors of the path come together. That's why it's an integrated path. It's a whole path. We can't leave anything out. And so while we're developing the path, we don't really see that yet. We see part of it. We understand some things and not other things. It's only at the end, and you can look back over the whole journey, and you realize, ah, that's why it works like that. So this is the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path, as taught by the Buddha, the Majjhima Patipada, the middle way. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. So hopefully that's given you some encouragement in that practice, maybe some clarification for a few of those things. Definitely something if you, I'd encourage you to go away and read up a little bit. There's excellent books and so on about that. And, you know, you should see if you can memorize all of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a very good, only take you a few minutes to do it. And then once you've got it there, it's always there ready for you. Okay, so this is my talk for you this evening. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions. Oh, do we do that? Or do we just have the iPad? Do we just have iPads these days? Do we have human questions or just iPad questions? We have both, do we? Okay, well, we'll do a couple of iPad questions and we'll see if we have time. All right. Okay, Raymond from Germany. G'day, Raymond. How's it going? What importance or role do singing bowls have in Buddhism? I've seen a video of a Buddhist nun using it for meditation and healing. So, singing bowls. Did you know that bowls could sing? Do you know what they mean by singing bowls? Yeah. So, I don't know. We haven't got one around here. I can give a demonstration. But if you've got like these bells that you use for bowls that you use for bells, and you get a kind of a donga like this, and you can sort of go around and it'll make a sound, and it makes a beautiful kind of very peaceful sound. So it's just one of the things that we can do in Buddhism to, you know, just to help to create a peaceful mood. So like a lot of these things, they're not essential by any means, but you know, it does help sometimes. Those kind of use of sacred objects in that way can help to sort of set the mood and to bring you down and to ground you in time and place. So that's how people often use that. Okay, so James from the UK. G'day, James. How's it going? I am a lay Buddhist that relies mainly on an online community. And in that, of course, you are far from being alone. This is how many people today experience Buddhism. I often become confused when I come across a thicket of views related to concentration or jhana. Now, I hope after hearing what I just said about concentration, you would probably have rephrased that. But anyway, maybe this is another part of that thicket of views that's causing the confusion. How can I balance my personal experience with the guidance of other lay Buddhists? Okay, so yes, there is a thicket of views when it comes to the question of jhana and these kinds of things. What do I say here? Ajahn Brahm is right and the other guys are not. I don't know if that's diplomatic enough. I mean, I've written a number of books about this. If you're interested to look, I wrote a book called The Swift Pair of Messengers that addresses that specific question, another book called The History of Mindfulness that also addresses that. In my opinion, I don't want... It's too much to go into a detailed of a technical discussion of this, but think of it that in our culture, which we used to think of as a Western Buddhist culture, but in fact is a global Buddhist culture, right? So in this kind of global Buddhist culture, it is still very immature. We're still finding our way, and we're still discovering what meditation is, what it means, and these kinds of things. And that is really, that's an evolving and a changing perspective. If we were to ask a question about Buddhist meditation, for example, say 20 years ago, this question wouldn't have been asked because nobody was talking about jhanas in Buddhism 20 years ago. Now people are talking about it, okay? And people have different ideas about it. And that will remain the case, and that will change and that will evolve, okay? And that's not a bad thing. But if you see it as in terms of a dialogue and an evolution within the community, then you realize, okay, we're just learning how to talk about these things in a very new idiom, in a very new environment and context. So it's very natural that people have different ideas about it and so on. But the most important thing from a practical point of view is just, well, what leads to peace of mind? That's all. If you're anxious, let go of the anxiety. If you're stressed, let go of the stress. If you're depressed, find happiness. That's all. And to keep on doing that, and to keep on deepening your practice, that's all that really matters in the end. The only problem, actually, with these different ideas is if it makes you stop, if it makes you think, oh yeah, that's it. You know, I mean, I have people come up to me sometimes, they're like, oh yeah, I've got jhanas, and then I'm thinking, oh, what's next? No, that does not happen. Okay? You don't get jhanas and then think, what's next? Right? You get jhanas and you think, oh my God, the world just exploded. Okay? My life will never be the same. Right? So just keep on becoming more and more peaceful. Keep on letting go, and then gradually you experience the taste of things for yourself. And meanwhile, you know, you can learn from all these different Dhamma teachers. Even you might disagree with some things that they say, or you might be not sure whether you agree with everything they say. But on the other hand, you know, most of what they say will be useful and good, and you can learn from it, okay? This is also very important to bear in mind. Right? We don't get too caught up in these details, because actually the practical things that matter for most people, these are not questions on how we define jhana or something like that. These are, you know, how do we let go of the five hindrances, the things that are actually causing us suffering. Okay, so Jessica from Hong Kong. How's it going, Jessica from Hong Kong? I have a question on right view. If I understand well, right view is about what brings us peace. Okay. Ultimately, yeah, interesting point. Yeah, does this mean that there are different right views for different people, or can we find right view in different ways? And if nothing is permanent, does it mean that right view is also evolving with time? Well, okay, a number of interesting questions there, which I'll try to unpack at least a little bit. Right view is what brings us peace. That's true, although, I mean, it might not do it, you know, immediately. And I mean, right view isn't perfect to start with, right? So, you know, sometimes you might be discussing Dhamma with somebody. It might even get heated, right? And you've got different opinions. And you might not feel very peaceful at that moment, right? But still, you're helping to improve your understanding of Dhamma. So, you know, it's still contributing to lead to peace in the long term. So, yes, it does lead to peace, but you know, sometimes the opposite is also true. So, for example, if there's a problem that needs addressing, right, then it's easy sometimes to shut yourself off from it, to turn away from it, say, oh, I'm not going to bother about that, it's not nothing to do with me, right? And then you just go away and meditate and so on, and you feel, oh, I'm more peaceful now than I was if I'd been dealing with that problem, right? But of course the problem is still there, and then it will come back, and it will get you when you're not expecting it. So yes, right view is what leads to peace, but it's not necessarily what leads to the most sort of short-term peace, right? It's a long-term deep peace that we're after. Okay, does it mean there's different right view for different people, or can we find right view in different ways? Well, certainly we can find right view in different ways. That's not complicated, right? So some of us will spend more time studying, some of us more time meditating, some of us more time listening to Dhamma talk, some more time discussing, and so on. And we'll also have different things that we're interested in. Some people will be interested in Buddhism to address psychological stress, and some people might be interested in the philosophical side of Buddhism, and so on. So, yeah, of course, we all come to it in different ways. That's not difficult. But does it mean that there's different right view for different people? Well, there certainly can be different expression of right view, different interpretations of right view. Where there can be really different right view, I'm not so sure. I mean, the world just is how it is. Yeah. Remember what I said before about like a map. So we think of right view as like a map from point A to point B. Yeah. So certainly we can have different maps that will be equally good at getting us from point A to point B. Right. That's not a problem. But at the end of the day, we've got to end up at the same place. So anyway, I hope that's clarified that a little bit. And finally, if nothing is permanent, does it mean that right view is evolving in time? Well, again, it certainly means that the expression of right view is evolving in time, but the fundamentals of human nature and so on aren't changing. And this is something which is also spoken about in the suttas, and it's a bit of a subtle point, and one of the kind of more subtle points in Buddhist philosophy, but the Buddha talked about this thing called Dhamma Pitata. It means the persistence or the regularity or the stability of natural law, of the Dhamma. And so what that means is that, for example, you think about impermanence, right? Everything is impermanent, yeah? But yesterday everything was impermanent, and tomorrow everything will be impermanent. In 100 years' time, everything will be impermanent, and 1 million years ago, everything was impermanent. So impermanence is permanent. Right? Yeah, it's very true. And it couldn't be any other way. Right? Because if impermanence was impermanent, that would mean that impermanence stopped being impermanent, and then it would be permanent. Yeah? So this is the difference. So the things, all the phenomena in the world are impermanent, but these principles like the Four Noble Truths and so on, these are really just descriptions of how things are. And those descriptions of how things are always accurate. So it's always accurate to describe things as being impermanent. Right? It's always accurate to describe the human condition as being subject to suffering. So those basic fundamental truths, they don't evolve, but the expression, the way that we deal with it, the way that we implement it, then they certainly do evolve and change, and they're dependent on time and place and culture and context and all of those kinds of things. So that's a bunch of very interesting questions there. Thank you, Jessica from Hong Kong. And I'm sure I didn't address them at all satisfactorily, but that's the best I can do in a short time. I don't know, do we have time to take any questions from the audience? Do we have time to do that? Sorry, Alan. Uh-huh, not self? Sorry? Yes. So the question was, what about not self? Is this part of right view? Yes, of course it is. And so this is, there's many different aspects that we can discuss under right view. And all of those wisdom teachings of the Buddha come under that, like the five aggregates and the six senses and dependent origination and impermanent suffering and not self and so on and so forth. And so they're all part of right view. And again, that's part of what I mentioned before, that there are different approaches. So there are different things that will click with different people. So somebody might hear a teaching on impermanence and they go, okay, and that's what causes you to let go. Somebody else hears a teaching on interdependence and they go, yes, I realize that, yeah? Somebody else hears a teaching on not self. Actually, it's all pointing to the same truth, but is approaching it from different ways. Yeah. At the back there. Prem, is that Prem? Sorry, I've got lights in my eyes here, so it looks like Prem.
Just pointing out that the basic five precepts or the eight precepts is fundamental to the Noble Eightfold Path.
That's right. Yeah. So the five precepts are part of the factor on the right speech and right action are included within the five precepts there. But the five precepts, of course, being like a kind of minimal standard. I know a lot of people think the five precepts are like, you know. So in some ways, yes, it's something to aspire to, right? To never have a drink of alcohol. We were discussing that before we came over. Like, it's just like a little drink every now and then, okay? So, okay, we don't want to be too dogmatic about this, right? No one's going to come down on you heavily if you have an occasional drink or something like that. It's not such a big deal. But, you know, it's something to aspire to. But there's so much to these things beyond just keeping the precepts. Yeah.
Yes, but at least it's a start.
It's a very good start, yeah.
Ajahn Sujato, sorry.
Yeah.
Ajahn, we all know that when the Buddha gained enlightenment, he expounded the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, okay?
Yeah.
That is suffering and end of suffering, okay? So my question is, you know, I always thought there is another parallel or hidden path, you know, the path towards nirvana. And the path towards nirvana is a annihilation path, you know, getting rid of greed, hatred, delusion, jealousy, mm-hmm. hatred, ill will, anger, blah, 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 all the things. No?
Huh?
You know, like, there's a higher path than the Eightfold Path. Do you know what I mean?
No, that's not right.
You know, like,
it's not often that I get to say that, actually.
Sorry? So I might be wrong. I just thought, I just might ask you, is it?
You no, it's the same path. Eightfold Path is precisely for overcoming greed, hatred, and delusion, right? If you look at the factors of the Eightfold Path, right view is for overcoming delusion. Mm. Right intention is for overcoming hatred and greed, mm-hmm. right? Right speech also, you know, by not lying, then you're overcoming delusion. Right actions, by refraining from killing, for example, you're overcoming or you're developing overcoming hatred by not killing, and so on and so forth. So all of the factors of the Eightfold Path have their own role mm-hmm. in helping to overcome greed, hatred, and delusion.
Then how do you distinguish between enlightenment and nirvana?
Knowing
that nirvana is an annihilation path, you know, getting rid of all the defilements.
You don't. It's the same thing. Both nirvana and enlightenment are defined by the Buddha as the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, that's all.
Thank you. I thought it's a different thing. I thought, you know, not like a slightly different. I thought it could be a little... No, it's parallel, hidden, you know. One is annihilation.
There's no secret
one is
path
the,
in Buddhism.
Enlightenment, he gained knowledge. Sorry, I just asked. You know,
I know. I think I know what you mean. That you're talking like there's a way of talking about things that can be like positive, like you're saying, like gaining knowledge and developing things and so on. And then there's a way of talking about it which is negative, like letting go of things and cessation and so on. So yeah, but these are just different ways of talking about the same thing. Yeah, so you can talk about developing wisdom, or you can talk about abandoning delusion. Actually, it's the same thing.
It could be the same. It could be slightly different to what you think. Sorry. Depending
no,
on your mind, how you approach it, the teachings, isn't it?
No, it's the same thing, Eddie. Trust me.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, so getting a little bit late, maybe we should be wrapping up. And no more announcements, anything like that? Just that, can people still buy the tickets for the conference? That's still up. So if you want to get your early bird tickets for the conference, then you can get them now. And that'll only be for, I think, this week and next week, isn't it? To 2 weeks, yeah? So, yeah. Very good. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.